Trips are exciting, whether we're heading home for the holidays or visiting someplace for the first time, but getting there can be tiring. And if you're not paying attention to your body, you can arrive cramped and cranky. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer with UW Sports Medicine Spine Center, one of our guests. Great to see you, Lori.
Good to be back.
And Bill Boisenault, associate professor, full professor in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, senior physical therapist at the Spine Center Physical Therapy Clinic. Bill, great to see you.
Great to be back, as always, Larry.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, we have holiday plans, most of us do, you know, going somewhere, either in the car or in the plane, typically. What are some good tips to avoid aches and pains on the long car trips? Let's take that first.
Well, I think the first good news is that my parents are not driving here from Iowa, so everyone will be safer.
The roads are safer.
The roads are much safer.
It's good to know. Good.
Long car rides. Well, the advice I like to give is your trip starts when you get in the car, not when you arrive at your destination. So I think the first thing is changing your mindset about your trip, not dreading the trip or this or that only as a means to get to your destination. But think about how the drive can be part of the experience, whether it's listening to books on tape or planning stops along the way of things that you'd like to see, giving yourself extra time so you're not frantically feeling rushed like you have to get somewhere. So give yourself extra time. Take your time. Stop more frequently and adjusting your seat and so on, things like that. But I think changing your mental attitude about the trip into part of the experience will help get you in the right mental frame.
Yeah,
it helps to deal with the cramped and cranky syndrome. You know, we're all busy. We're all last minute preparations. But like Lori said, if you can make that adjustment in the schedules and the breaks are important. Even if they're for 10 minutes and get out and walk and stretch a little bit. And Lori also mentioned you can change your car seat. You know, you can move a little closer to the dash, a little further away from the dash. In most cars, you can change the angle of the back rest. Just change the position of your spine makes for a happier spine by the end of the trip.
Yeah, I certainly would agree with that. You know, I was just thinking the fact that cars get more mileage now, better gas mileage, means that we're probably in the car longer than normal because we're not stopping for gas more often.
That's a good point.
Consciously make the effort to stop. You're right. That is a good point.
Well, what about air? Is there anything different about traveling by air? I frankly like to get to the airport really early, but you wind up sitting around a little bit longer maybe, but then you're avoiding a lot of
if you can get there and use that time to walk up and down, you know, rather than just sitting there. I mean, you have a pretty good idea what time you're going to board and things like that. But just doing some walking back and forth so that you're loosened up and a little bit of stretching. I know sometimes people stare at me, but I like to stretch before I get on the plane. Otherwise, I'm so stiff when I get off.
Yeah. You know, the seats in many airplanes are not the best, you know, in terms of ergonomic design. They kind of force you to sit more of a C curve. That over time can cause some stiffness and some soreness. You know, if you can find a small pillow, instead of putting it behind your head, put it in the small of your back. For many people, it just keeps us in a little more of our normal lordotic curve. And every half hour or so, you can pull it out. So again, your back is changing positions. That can help some. Where some people get into trouble relates to luggage. So whether you're trying to get a piece up above, which can really be a challenge when, you know, it's tight quarters, make sure you get your feet, your legs underneath you as you lift that piece of luggage up into the overhead bin or getting out of the bin. And if you're checking your luggage, getting it off the carousel can be really tricky for some people, especially if the luggage is heavy. And again, the more you can use your legs, the less your back has to do.
And when you're on the plane, you know, keeping the circulation through your lower legs by doing little toe raises, you know, in your mm-hmm. seat, going up and down and pulling your toes up and wiggling your toes and bringing your knees in and out and things like this, just to keep some good circulation through your legs mm-hmm. will be helpful, especially for those times at the beginning and the end where you're forced to stay in your seat.
Yeah.
You know, and thinking about people's necks, if you're the type of person who conks out as soon as the plane starts taxiing, falling asleep, I've seen some people, they fall asleep and their head is just forward hanging down. And, you know, after an hour, hour and a half of that, you can have a pretty stiff and sore neck. You know, they have the neck supports, the neck pillows. You wear like a collar. So if you're a person who sleeps very easily or readily on a plane, it's good to have one of those collar pillows like that to keep your neck in more of an upright, neutral position too.
And then depending upon the time of year, I mean, and this is Thanksgiving, so it's cooler. If you can plan to bring the right jacket, you can use that jacket and kind of roll it up into a neck pillow or mm-hmm. a low back pillow. Because sometimes those little pillows are not the right size for your low back, so you can use your jacket or sweater to adjust that. So if you plan on that, that can be helpful.
And, you know, you get a twitch like that or an ache, say, how long is that usually? I mean, can you expect that to go away in a week or what?
Well, I think for most people, you know, coming out of a plane trip or a car trip, some stiff and soreness, you know, especially when you reach your destination, hopefully you have a chance to walk and move around. You know, usually fairly quickly within a couple of hours, people are moving pretty good. If you have an existing back problem or an existing neck problem, then it might take a day or two to recover from it. Again, what delays that is if you reach your destination and then you're sitting again.
Yeah.
which lots of us do, especially around the holidays. And so, you know, it's good to be moving and kind of keep some movement or exercise routine going even when you're not at home.
Mm-hmm. I know my wife has a little back issues, and if she has to run.
Yeah.
If she doesn't run, her back.
Yeah.
She's out. I guess I haven't run for a day or two because my back started aching.
She knows it, yeah.
And I think that the other piece would be, if you think about the return trip, you really need to step back and look at what you're eating on Thanksgiving and over the next couple of days. If you're eating stuff with a lot of salt, you may have more fluid retention, and that can make you more uncomfortable. So really being thoughtful about what you're eating and how it may impact your comfort on your return trip, I think, is also important.
Let's give our listeners a chance to join in. If you have a question, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. Go to The Larry Mueller Show. That's the Facebook page for that. Gary in the town of Ween, thank you for calling. Hi, Gary.
Good morning, Larry. Great show.
Thank you.
Every year for at least 20 years now, I've had some back issues, and I go out west for 25 days, mountain climbing, hiking, camping, etc. My chiropractor one year told me, he said, when I'm driving across the Dakotas or Nebraska, he said, about every 2 hours, stop at a wayside, get out, and do some stretches, you know. And so I take along my yoga mat, and within every 2 hours, pull into a wayside, get out, spend 10, 15 minutes. I have a series of stretches and poses to do. Throw a few frisbees with a friend, and off we go. And if you're nice to your back's nice to you.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. And it's a combination of, you know, it's making yourself stop. You know, like you mentioned earlier, we're not stopping as often because we don't need gasoline as often in most cases. And so it's really making that effort. And what Lori said before, kind of planning that into your trip. You don't need to stop for hours, you know 10 minutes, mm-hmm. maybe 15 minutes, and get a little movement, get a little stretching, get a lot of mileage out of that.
Thanks, Gary, for calling. Appreciate your call. I'm going to give Will in West Milwaukee a chance to join in. Hi, Will. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Years ago, several years ago, I was putting some snow tires in the trunk of a car and had some kind of an injury. And I had an eval by a physical therapist, and she said it was a bicep tendon which popped out of its channel. She put her finger right on it, and there was the pain, she could tell. And her advice was just to continue my range of motion that I was doing for the torn shoulder, what do they call that?
Rotator cuff?
Rotator cuff, right. And then I was doing some push-ups, too, and she said that to make sure I go all the way up on the push-ups, on the upstroke. But this year, again, I got some pain. I don't know if it's the same thing, but I was listening to the Dr. Zorba show, and they were describing a ruptured tendon. And I don't know if my symptoms are of that. The bicep looks strange. It looks like it's curled up a little. It looks kind of odd, like I gained muscle all of a sudden. And then when I put my forearm on a table and I put the palm up, the bicep goes up just like the other one, but on the injured one, it seems like there's this gel that comes down and just floats on down. And the pain of it is started out just as a drawing, but then it became a sharp pain way near the top of the shoulder, not on the horizontal plane of the shoulder, but just about to where it would go horizontal. And so I'm wondering what you folks think of that. And by the way, on that program, they said there was nothing could be done about it as far as surgery.
So the biceps, that's a change, you know, seeing the little curl up, that's a change from when you saw the physical therapist however many years ago?
And the funny thing is, when I do heavier things, it doesn't bother me, but it's when I do something where I'm twisting my forearm and bending it at the same time, bending my elbow at the same time, such as brushing my teeth.
Okay, that's such a perfect description. I don't think I could have done a better job. That's exactly what that is. It's a ruptured biceps. So probably previously you had some injury to that tendon and now it is completely ruptured. Although people think of their biceps as being the primary elbow bender, it actually isn't. It's actually the primary forearm rotator. And it assists in elbow flexion. The reason that you don't necessarily have to do anything about it is that it's not your main elbow bender. There's another head of the biceps that continues to do that, and there's a couple other muscles in your upper arm and forearm that also bend your elbow. So you can continue to function pretty well, but you will have trouble with that rotating when you're rotating and bending your elbow at the same time, because that's the primary biceps movement. And there really isn't anything to be done about it other than to treat the symptoms and making sure that other muscle groups stay strong and your shoulder stays healthy and so on and so forth.
So any particular exercises for that?
Well, I'd probably suggest that you go back to that physical therapist that you saw earlier and get your exercises reevaluated. I'm not sure of the status of your rotator cuff, but it's going to be important to keep your rotator cuff strong, your other shoulder muscles strong, and your forearm. And giving you the wrong ones, if they're not done properly, can make your shoulder worse. So I'd rather have someone look at you and do specific muscle testing of the muscles in that arm and give you the right program.
Yeah, makes good sense. Well, thank you for calling, and good luck. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Talking today about physical therapy issues with Bill Boisenault and Lori Time Brody. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody, UW-Madison, physical therapists, athletic trainers, and experts extraordinaire when it comes to all those aches and pains and sprains and so forth that you might be experiencing. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Here's an email from Jim in Mequon. Twisted my back doing yard work on Saturday. My back has been spasming since, and it's sometimes disabling, frankly. I'm using enteric-coated aspirin and heat. What else do you suggest? How long should I wait until seeing a doctor?
Yeah, it's that time of the year. Yard work, raking, and shoveling is going to start pretty soon as well. In terms of seeing your physician or seeing a physical therapist, as long as there are no symptoms shooting down into the legs, especially below the knee, as long as there's no numbness or tingling down into the legs or the feet, or bowel or bladder changes, for most people, what Jim is describing should resolve within a few days, maybe a week or two. Studies show that bed rest more than 24 to 48 hours is a bad thing. It ends up causing more problems than helping. And so you want to stay as active as possible, avoiding things that cause any pain, that sharp catching or shooting. So walking, short walks, gentle movement tends to go a long way to help the recovery. There are some gentle stretches that people can do. It's best to do them what we call a non-weight-bearing position. So you lie on your back, you gently pull one knee up towards your chest, then do other leg, and then pull both knees up towards your chest. Then you roll over onto your stomach, and you prop up on your elbows to get a nice gentle arch in your back. Being on your hands and knees and just rocking hips back towards your heels, again, is a really gentle way to stretch those muscles out, get the blood flow moving through that area. And, you know, again, really within a couple of days, people should start feeling better. If after probably 2-3 weeks, 4 weeks, if it's not getting any better or getting worse, then that's where some care could be very helpful. And again, seeing their family practice physician or seeing a physical therapist can help them figure out why they're not recovering as quickly as you would expect someone to.
Yeah, that raking business. I've now that we've been a couple of years at our new quote-unquote home. The neighbors on one side have probably a 200-year-old tree, and the neighbors on the other side of us have another 200-year-old tree.
Oh, jeez.
The one loses all of its leaves over time, but most of them wind up in our yard.
Yeah.
And the other one does not lose its leaves. It waits until
all the other leaves are raked.
Until you've raked all the other leaves. Right?
All the leaves from the other tree. I'm not kidding. It does not drop a leaf until the other one's dropped all its leaves. And then it drops all its leaves. And they somehow managed to wind up in our...
Too
yard.
Funny.
Yeah. So raking, as you were talking about, be kind of careful.
It can really get people in trouble, whether it's their shoulders, rotator cuff issues, or low back. And especially if the leaves are heavy, if they're wet.
Yeah.
And even if you have a blower, doesn't work very well. But if they're wet, you have to take breaks. You know, try to use one arm and then use the other arm. And maybe every 20, 30 minutes, take a break, do something else.
Raking and vacuuming are two of the really tough activities. I think it's that unilateral, that rotation that happens with that, you know, the constant bending and straightening of your trunk and then the rotation with it, that asymmetrical pull tends to really get people. People have back pain. Those are the two toughest things.
You know, and I was thinking about that because the vacuum cleaner. Now, I was vacuuming. I was on the weekend, and we have three floors, and so... Carrying that
up and down. Yeah.
Up and down.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, why did we not? I've got to get a long hose or something.
Or get three of them.
Or
one
get three
for each
vacuums,
floor.
One for each floor.
Yeah,
there
one for each
go.
Floor. That might do it. That might be, Judith says that's what they have. They have one on each floor.
Yeah, it might be worthwhile because the dragging it up and down, you know, first of all, it's
heavy.
You're holding it.
Yeah. And then you're going down.
Right, and then you're risking a fall with that.
Right.
So.
Right.
Yeah, it might be a worthwhile investment.
Yeah, I think
put it on your holiday wish list.
Might be a Christmas
Don't
present.
Don't anyone dare buy me a vacuum, just for the record.
Marina called, 45 years old, and when she took a one-hour flight, she experienced peripheral edema. As a result, she's nervous about getting back on a plane. Is there anything she can do to avoid that in the future? What is peripheral edema first, and then...
Well, it's probably, I'm assuming it's probably in her legs, swelling in her legs. Periphery means of the limbs, either
okay,
arms or
yeah.
legs. And it's not.
Edema is?
Swelling. Yeah, I'm sorry. So fluid accumulation. And as Lori described before, when we're sitting and the back of that, the edge of the seat is up against the backs of our knees, it decreases venous return, blood getting back up toward the heart. And so fluid can pool in the lower legs. After 1 hour flight, that's a pretty short flight to notice swelling like that. So I guess my first recommendation would be is if this is something new or seems to be getting worse, that she should see her physician because it's unusual to have significant edema after a 1 hour flight.
Yeah, that's pretty short.
It is. And, you know, to find out what's causing it and then have that managed. And, you know, there are special stockings people can wear. The active movement that Lori described before, coming up on your toes and doing circles with your toes can help keep the blood moving. But Have that kind of swelling in a one-hour flight is...
I wonder if she's sitting for 2 hours before the flight and not moving and then just getting up to get on the plane. Would that...
Could be. Well, I'd...
Could be part of it?
Well, it's possible, but it also could be that she's got some kind of underlying condition that's predisposing her to that. And if she hasn't seen her physician, those things really should be ruled out first.
That makes sense.
We just treat the symptoms of the edema.
All right, let's turn to Lane in Burlington next. Lane, hi, thanks for calling.
Hello. Hey, I was racing with my granddaughter, and about my fifth sprint, I pulled hamstring muscle.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
Did you do that just to get out of the racing? Grandpa pulled his hamstring, honey.
Yeah, I just tried walking that off, and this was about a month ago. And I've been doing some stretching on it. I wonder if you have any further advice for that.
Are you having any other symptoms besides just some discomfort in your hamstring?
It's basically good until I walk for a little over an hour, or if I try to go in to just a slight jog. I'm pretty much out of running most of the time, no problem. Just if I overuse it or try to put any speed on it, then I'll have problems with it.
Okay. So what have you done to rehabilitate it?
I've been icing off and on and doing some stretching on that.
Is it as flexible as your other hamstring?
The right hamstring's good. I haven't really had any problems with that.
Okay. Is this one back to the same as the other leg, though, in terms of its flexibility?
I can stretch further with the right leg than I can with the injured one.
Okay. All right. So continuing to work on your flexibility would be good, but it's time to start a little bit of strengthening, too, as in a gentle hamstring curl. I don't know if you have any ankle weights or resistive bands to start with that. But the hamstring is a speed muscle, which is why you have difficulty when you start increasing the speed. It can handle the lower speeds or the jog, but when you put any speed on it, that's when it goes. So typically rehabilitation would work on flexibility, on baseline strength at a slow speed, and then it would start to advance you to higher speeds. So if it's an isolated hamstring and you're feeling it right in the middle of that muscle belly in the back, you know, you can proceed under that assumption. The other thing to consider is that it's referred pain from someplace else. You've injured your back or something like that. But if you're pretty certain it's an isolated hamstring, that's the way the rehabilitation would typically go. So you're a month out. And it sounds like you haven't done much but stretch, so you could try a strengthening program, try to up the speed a little bit, and if you're still hitting the wall, you should probably go in and get some guidance on it, because the hamstrings can be tough to rehab.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Ingrid in Wauwatosa, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, here's my backstory. I've had meniscus tears in both my knees, arthroscopy. First one, right knee, did great. That was 6 years ago. The second one, a year and a half ago, and I've never felt like I've recovered from it. That one's had chronic swelling. So this October, my orthopedist gave me, I think it's a Synvesc injection, times three. And now I can say actually the swelling's less, but during that time period, and this is why I saw him again recently, is I have this different kind of pain, and I said, I feel like we're missing something. You know, is it my IT band, blah, blah, blah. And what the pain is it goes, it starts on the outside of the knee and almost curves to a U, and it's worse at night. And it's really bad at night, like a throbbing. So he said to me, and then, you know, my knee does buckle. I hear clicks now, like as if something is catching, and I guess it is. I guess I have a spur there. But after doing x-rays of my hips and my knees, he said we need to rule out that the source is the hip and do an injection. And I was like, wait, just send me to physical therapy first, because I thought maybe my yoga is exacerbating it. So what do you think?
I think that sounds like a good plan. If you haven't had any structured physical therapy, I would start with that and see how far you get before you start injections. I mean, obviously your hip can be a contributor in that if you are having hip pain or problems with your hip, it can change how you move and walk and so on. Really, in your age group, primary hip problems, and Bill will correct me if I'm wrong, don't refer to the knee. In adolescence, they can. If you have a slip capital femoral epiphyses, they call them a skiffy, that can have, you can have no hip symptoms, but can have only knee pain associated with that. But in adults, typically primary hip problems don't refer to the knee. They can both occur together, each with their own separate issue, but hip doesn't refer to the knee. So I think starting in physical therapy sounds like a really good idea. A lot of times hip weakness can be a cause or a major contributor to knee symptoms. So I think looking at your hip musculature and how you move and your flexibility and your posture may get you fairly far along. But I don't think intra-articular hip pathology would be the first place I'd start.
Oh, yeah. Good. I'm glad to hear that. And actually, but also, how do you think like having, I have a pretty bad bunion on that side. Could that strain my knee? My internist once said that to me.
That's a great, again, mechanical question. So if you have a bunion on that side, but not on the other side?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you have a bunion, the bunion doesn't create the problem. The bunion is a sign or a symptom that you've been walking abnormally on that side. The bunion is a response to excessive loading on your first metatarsophalangeal joint. It's a sign that you've overloaded your big toe joint. And you overload your big toe joint when you're mechanically out of whack on that side. So you could have a leg length difference. You could have a weakness. You could have any of a number of things that have resulted in you walking and moving in a way that overloads your foot. So that whole leg, that whole kinetic chain from your foot to your knee to your hip, potentially to your back, may be involved and may be amenable to, for example, a sacroiliac joint mobilization or manipulation because you have a leg length difference that comes from your hip, or maybe you have a primary leg length difference. There's all kinds of possibilities. But starting with PT, where they can examine you from stem to stern and figure out why that's happening, would probably get you pretty far.
That's real interesting because 15 years ago, I was diagnosed with SI joint syndrome, and that's been a bane of my existence on and off. Less lately, I think, because the knee pain bothered it more.
Yeah.
That's real interesting. So that's like, it's all like connected.
Yeah, it's like that song, the leg bone connected to the backbone, to the neck bone. And again, you know, mentioning these different things to the physical therapist will be very helpful. But as Lori said, they will examine you from your foot on up and along the way identify, all right, what seems to be the source of symptoms, but more important, what's driving those symptoms, what's causing those symptoms. And they may do things related to your big toe and your foot. They may do things in terms of core strengthening or your sacroiliac joint. So when you go in, you know, I would bring shoes that you typically wear. Sometimes the wear and the bottom of shoes give some clues as what may be going on. And they should be able to come up with a good program for you.
Mm-hmm. I'll just share a little personal experience because I preach this stuff, but I don't necessarily, you know, you never practice what you preach. So I went into one of the PTs that I work with because I was having this horrible shin and ankle pain. And I couldn't figure out what I did. I'm like, I can't walk down the stairs. I can't do anything. This is killing me. Can you look at my ankle? She said, your SI joint is out. I said, get out of here. She mobilized my SI joint and my ankle pain went away. And if it hadn't been me, if it hadn't happened to me, I'd have said, I'd have never believed
him. No way.
So,
there you go.
There you have it.
Ingrid, thank you and good luck. Appreciate your call. And we'll take some more calls. You can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Brian in Sheboygan, you are next. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Hey, I appreciate the opportunity. Can anything be really done? I've got a series of bad headache issues that come up, intense pain. Can anything be done for, like, I've had several concussions and a neck injury. I had some car accidents, and I used to ride horses quite a bit and got thrown quite a few times. Is there any sort of therapy that can be done to sort of, like, alleviate headache pain?
It depends on what's causing the headache. And it sounds like you have reasons to have headaches associated with your neck, maybe your posture secondary to injuries. That's the tricky part, is to try to determine what is the cause of the headaches. Headaches that are driven by musculoskeletal, you know, joint or muscle injuries, postural issues, physical therapy can make a huge difference. Sometimes the headache comes from our jaw joints, our temporomandibular joints, and physical therapists working with dentists often can help with those kinds of headaches. There are other causes of headaches. There are vascular headaches, migraine or cluster headaches that really need to see a physician for. So if your headaches, Brian, seem to be associated with certain postures or head neck movements or time of day or where you're driving or you're working, then having a physical therapist examine you, and they should be examining your back on up through your jaw joints, and they should be able to come up with a plan. If it's coming from the musculoskeletal system, physical therapy should be able to help you.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Nick in Whitewater, hi.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Great. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
I'm just frustrated. I bought a new pair of shoes for running. I spent quite a bit of money on them, and it seems like I do this to myself every time, and I can't use them because they create massive, like, back pain and like nervous nerve ending, like tingling, and it just creates this most uncomfortable feeling, and it feels like it forces my back to overarch while I'm running. And then it's just like, I don't know, it's frustrating because I run barefoot in the summer, but now I want to run in the winter, and I can't seem to find a pair of shoes. And it like takes like a day for my back to recover from going for like a 2-mile run.
So are you buying like barefoot running shoes, or are you buying traditional running shoes now?
Well, I bought traditional because I was trying to deal with the snow and stuff for the winter. I wanted to, you know, run throughout these this winter.
So really, you're changing your mechanics, correct?
Yeah, big time.
Yeah. So
yeah.
It's probably less about the shoe and more about how you run in the shoe. Is it possible for you to use the same kind of gait you use when you're barefoot running in the summer with your shoes in the winter? I mean, there's a lot of shoes out there. Can you not get one that looks more like a barefoot running shoe but still has protection? They sure make a lot of varieties of shoes out there.
Yeah, I went to the specialty running store, and I was kind of put my faith in this salesperson, and I guess I had been able to use running shoes in the past, so I keep hoping that I'll be able to use them again, and it just doesn't seem to work out.
Yeah, well, have you been evaluated? Have you had your gait evaluated? Your running gait?
No. I've read books and stuff how to run really properly, and I try to do that.
Okay. Well, it really sounds like you're changing your mechanics quite a bit. So there are places where you can get on a treadmill and have your gait evaluated, and you may be able to get some help with modifying your running to a different running style that maybe isn't completely heel strike first or completely forefoot strike first, but some kind of in between that you could tolerate. You might also benefit from that evaluation, because if you feel like you're arching your back a lot, you may be, and it may be that you need some abdominal exercises and some conscious awareness of your running posture that has to change a little bit when you change into those shoes. And there's research that shows that if you get put on a treadmill and someone is cueing you about your posture and muscle activation while you're running, you can, in the course of one session, change your running technique to one that's more suitable for you.
Yeah.
And Nick, they could assess your running in barefoot, and then you could put your shoes on, and then they could assess you again and maybe observe some pretty significant changes that, again, would clue you into what to modify or a certain set of exercises that may help you.
Mm-hmm. Good luck.
Sure, I know what's up.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I was thinking again about my wife when we were talking about shoes. She has there's a type of shoe that works for her perfectly, and she's tried other shoes, and now that company is going to be changing its the design of that shoe is changing, and so I think she ordered a couple more pairs.
A couple dozen would be a good idea.
Exactly. She was trying to get her hands on as many as she could, to be perfectly honest, because it just works. And Jim in Wausau, hi.
Hello. I started a walking program approximately 2 months ago, and I start to get pain on the outside of my shin bone about 20 minutes into the walk. I walk approximately 50 minutes at a time, and the pain about halfway through the walk starts to subside, go away sometimes, sometimes it doesn't. I'm assuming that it may be a shin splint. What can be done to avoid that? Is there any recommendations you have?
So this is on the outside of your shin?
Yeah, the outside of the shin bone, towards between the knee and the ankle.
Okay, and do you have any other symptoms, anything in your foot or ankle, any tightness, any other symptoms?
Not really. I don't have any problems. About halfway through the walk, of a 50-minute walk, it starts to kind of a sharp aching pain, and then sometimes towards the end of the walk it just seems to sort of subside.
Does it bother you any other time or only when you're doing your walking?
Only when I'm doing my walking.
Okay. And is it progressively getting worse, or is it kind of staying about the same?
It stays about the same.
Okay. Well, classic shin splints are typically on the inside of your shin, and they're due to foot and ankle posture. Pain on the outside is less common, and it can be related to what we call a compartment syndrome, but it doesn't sound like that. It sounds more just muscular tendinopathy, and so I'd be inclined to look at the surface that you're walking on. Are you walking on a fairly level surface or a banked road?
A blacktop road.
Okay, so, and you're walking against traffic?
Yes.
Yeah, it may be that surface, because it causes your ankles to rotate in that plane, the plane on the outside and inside of your ankle. No, I'm not going to tell you to walk in the middle of the road. That's it's probably pretty dangerous. But boy, if you could find a place to walk that's more level. My gut is that's the biggest contributing factor, is it's the bank of the road that's causing you some trouble. So
look around a little
bit. Yeah, so look around, see if you can find a more level place to walk for at least part of it would be my suggestion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's probably had the biggest impact. Jimmy, you could try doing a little calf stretching, some submaximal stretching before you walk, and then maybe halfway through your walk, and then at the end, kind of classic runner stretch for the calf. The other thing to think about, do you have a second or different pair of shoes that you could wear on a walk and see if the shoes are making the difference?
You know, that was my next move I was going to make, is maybe invest in a different pair of shoes just to see if that was the problem or not.
Yeah, I just keep an eye on it. It's not getting any worse now, but realize that when you walk on a banked road, the leg that's toward the middle of the road is higher than your other one. So anyone who has any kind of leg length sensitivity, if you start to feel hip pain or knee pain or back pain on one side or the other, that bank may be, you may be more sensitive to that bank in the road and the leg length difference than you're aware of.
Mm. Good luck. Thanks, Jim, for calling. Appreciate it. Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody, our guest today from the UW, Bill's with the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and also a senior physical therapist at the Spine Center Physical Therapy Clinic at UW Hospitals and Clinics. Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer with UW Sports Medicine and Spine Center. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're talking about your aches and pains and sprains and strains with Lori Tyne Brody and Bill Boisenault. Question for them, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And speaking of Facebook, Nola commented, we were talking earlier about vacuum cleaners and having one on every floor. And Nola said, I just got permission to buy a second Dyson. That bugger is too heavy to be hauling up and down the stairs. I will accept this as my holiday gift.
Very nice.
Good for you, Nola. Thanks. Thanks for sending that along. A Facebook comment from Leslie: as a massage therapist, I just thought it might be worth mentioning the power of massage therapy. Sounds like some of these minor aches and pains could be relieved from massage. And you're shaking your head, yes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, who doesn't feel better after a massage? I mean, definitely some aches and pains can be relieved, especially if there's soft tissue tightness or connective tissue tightness. Definitely. Can be helped by massage. So
yeah, there's times where sometimes when the stretching is just not giving you the relief that you think it should be or expecting to, that massage can help work some of the knots. You know, change can help facilitate a stretching program. There's lots of benefits for different people.
On another matter, we had an email from Juliet who was wondering why people think that they should be using heat when they first injure themselves. I was always told to use ice the first 72 hours after a new injury. What do you think?
Typically, that's the conventional wisdom to put cold on. You know, that being said, when you talk about the back, if you've, for example, injured your spine or some deep tissue, honestly, the heat and the cold, neither of them really penetrate deep enough to impact that either in a positive or negative way. So If it's a deep tissue and the heat causes, you know, relaxation and you feel better and can relax and stretch, then so be it. But if you have any doubt, ice is what we usually recommend.
Yeah, I think she may be alluding to, I think it was Jim that called with the yard work and he was using heat. And, you know, what I recommend to patients, just what Lori described, the more sharp and local the pain is, then probably ice would be better than heat. The sharp and local tends to be a little more superficial than mm-hmm. the type of pain that Lori's describing. If it's more diffuse and it's tightness, stiffness, achiness, then you really could use either in terms of whatever seems to work best or feel the best for you.
David in Wausau, appreciate your call. Hey. Thank you.
Hey. Yeah, thanks. Great show. I always look forward to listening to this show. Thank you, your guests, mm-hmm. for doing this. I'm 60 years old. I'm in pretty good shape. I was a basketball player and a skier my whole life, but just in the last 6 or 7 years, I've had a lot of issues with my left leg, a smashed ankle, a couple plates in there. That's all fine. It's actually my good ankle, or what I call my organic ankle, that's been bothering me lately.
okay.
And what I have is, and I've been to see a podiatrist for this. This is probably going to be a short answer on your part. Get a second opinion. But I have a ganglion cyst just below the apex of, on the outside of the, what I call the ankle bone. I forget the clinical term for it or the anatomical term. You know, the bone.
The fibula.
Yeah. No, it's the actual more oval-shaped floating bone that forms the part. Well, that is part of the tibia, isn't it? Anyway.
It is, yeah.
It just below that apex, skeletal apex on my ankle, just below that, is this cyst. And it's at least 2 years old, but it's growing. And the podiatrist pretty much just summarily dismissed it as causing any of my problems that I have. I don't take long walks. I don't do impact. I mean, I'm really careful with my ankles because I want to keep them. In as good a shape as we're in, but I don't do any impact at all. But on a long walk, you know, that ankle starts bugging me about an eighth of a mile into it.
So let me ask,
about the size of a marble now.
So what tendon is the ganglion in?
Well, if you touch the apex of that bone, the cyst is immediately below it. It sticks out past the apex of the bone.
Does it move when you pump your ankle up and down? Okay, so it's probably in the perineals.
I can manipulate it with my fingers, and it's a little tender if I push hard enough on it. And he just said, that can't be the problem.
Oh, well, anything that causes pain or discomfort can be a problem. So those muscles, those are your – so let's back up. A ganglion is it's a little cyst. It's like a bubble in a tire. So your tendons glide through a sheath that has fluid in it. And sometimes that sheath can have a weak spot, and it bubbles out like a bubble on a tire does. So the point is, if you go in and, for example, drain the fluid out, it usually comes back because it represents a weakness in the tendon sheath. And they can be painful, and mechanically it's going to change how you move. So it certainly can not necessarily be the direct cause of your pain, but it can be an indirect cause because you change what you do and how you do it. So, I mean, yes, getting a second opinion would be useful. You know, they don't.
How big should I let it get before I should?
I don't think you should let it get any bigger. It's bothering you now.
And a marble's big enough.
Yeah, it's big enough. Yeah, I'd see an orthopedic foot and ankle specialist. And get another opinion because it's bothering you enough where, well, first of all, you're calling us, but, you know, we're free. What good are we? but clearly you have a bad ankle on the other side, and this is impacting the quality of your life. So so it's time to get it checked out. So you're right.
Good luck, David. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate your call. And Bill in Madison. Hi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Morning. I have been ACL deficient since I was 18 years old in my left knee, and I played tennis and racquetball and did things throughout the years, but now I'm approaching 60, and an orthopedist has said, well, you know, we should go ahead and fix that, and I was just wondering if you've had any experience with having people have ACL repairs when they're in their, you know, 50s and 60s, and what kind of success rate do they have in the rehab area?
Well, let's back up. Why are you having it done now, 40
I'm
years
not.
Later?
I'm,
oh, why would you contemplate having it done? Are you symptomatic?
Well, it has gotten, I had to give up the racquetball and the tennis, and as I got into my 50s, but I'm still able to run and do all the other things I like to do, cycling and so forth.
Okay. Let me ask you this, Bill. Why did you have to give those up? Was your knee unstable? Were you having symptoms of instability?
Yes. It was starting to be obviously sliding around.
Okay. So, I mean, if you're having issues of instability, that would be a reason potentially to have it done. If your symptoms are pain or swelling or catching, those are not the signs of instability. Those are signs of a knee that's worn out, in which case getting your ACL done at this point in time wouldn't necessarily help. There are not many people in this world who go 40 years without their ACL who then go in and have it done. We don't have a lot of information on people like that. So if you haven't had any therapy or any rehab to look specifically at what you might do to dynamically stabilize your knee, I'd probably start with that before I had surgery. We can't really say what's going to happen when you now constrain your knee. In some cases, it could accelerate degenerative joint disease, which in your age group might be more problematic than the instability was. You know, given that you're still running and doing most things that don't require, you know, cutting, starting, stopping, it's going to be a trade-off. I don't think anyone can really tell you how it's going to go.
Sure.
All right. Thanks,
All right,
Bill.
Thank you.
Yep.
I think one of the things that would be important would be to know the state of his knee joint at this point in time. Does he have a lot of arthritis? Does he have wear and tear? What's the status of his meniscus? Because if he has fairly significant arthritis, which he may for being ACL deficient for that long, constraining his knee further has the potential to worsen that.
Mm-hmm.
So
lots to think about there.
Yeah, it's not a simple question. I don't envy his position.
Nancy in New Berlin, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm 80 years old, and I've been having trouble lately getting up from a sitting position. I can do it if it's a little bit higher, but if I'm in a church pew or whatever, I need to grab hold of something to get myself up. And I do exercise. I belong to Silver Sneakers and do different exercises, but and they do have us standing up in class, but I kind of have to push on the seat to stand up when I do those repetitions.
Okay. What about 30 seconds?
Okay. So, Nancy, is it pain or weakness?
No, I just can't do it.
Okay.
Just weakness.
All right. Then if this is new or has gotten significantly worse recently, and weakness in both legs, then you should go see your physician. If this is something that's more long-standing, then there are some good exercises to do to strengthen your quads.
And you know what? We'll talk some more about that. Let's take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with our guests, and we'll talk some more about that. Stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at injuries today. Maybe you've got an old one, or maybe you got a new one that you're trying to recover from, or maybe it's something just annoying you in that sort of fashion. Lori Tyne Brody and Bill Boisenault are here to give you their advice. Bill's a professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Lori, physical therapist, athletic trainer with UW Sports Medicine and Spine Center. And, you know, Bill, just before our news break, we were talking with Nancy, who's 80 years old, trouble actually getting from sitting to standing, and a weakness issue. I'm wondering.
Yeah, especially if she's sat on something low, it's more difficult for her to get up. And that's a pretty common issue as we age. And, you know, and it wasn't pain. She said it was more weakness, more difficulty. You know, we get a little nervous about weakness when it's large muscle groups like your quadriceps or your glutes, if this happens quickly, relatively quickly. So if there's been a change compared to 1 week ago or 2-3 weeks ago, then the best thing to do is for people to see their physician and describe the troubles they're having. My sense from what Nancy described, if it's more gradual over time, you know, there's no difference in her ability compared to 2-4 weeks ago, but compared to a couple of months ago having a little more trouble, then it can just be a matter of he just needs some more strengthening focused on her glutes and quadriceps. She's in an exercise class, but it sounds like there's nothing that's addressing this specifically. There's a couple of good exercises that relate to the movement of getting up from a chair. One, a relatively safe way, is we call a wall slide. So people stand, they have their back against a door, probably a door is the best, and their feet maybe a foot or so away from the door, and they, you know, just gently slide their back down the door so they're kind of moving toward a seated position, and maybe start by coming down halfway, two-thirds of the way, and then really pushing themselves, sliding back up the door using their glutes and their quadriceps. Another way is simply to sit in a chair that has armrests, a chair that maybe is a little lower than Nancy's usual comfort level, and then just simply practice getting up from the seated to standing position and use the arms as little as possible, but as much as she needs to help facilitate that motion, and go up and down 8, 10, 12 times, rest for 30 seconds and do that again, and that can be done a few times during the course of the day.
Sounds good advice.
So that's generally what I described to people with what Nancy presented.
Perfect. And again, Nancy from New Berlin, thank you so much. Leanne in Green Bay, it's your turn. Thanks for calling. Hi, Leanne.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. It's a long story, but I'll make it very short. Basically, I'm exploring the possibility of getting a stand-up workstation. I'm sure you have heard those before.
Yep.
Two of my colleagues have them. One was thinking to lose some weight. The other one was trying to kind of deal with his back pain. And my issue is I do have a back pain, lower back pain as well, and I believe it's primarily caused by my poor posture. So I'm wondering if getting one of those stand-up workstations would actually help my posture in any way. Is it really worthwhile?
Well, a couple things. A sitting posture can certainly get people into trouble after hours and hours. And I guess I'm assuming you've tried a couple different chairs or using lumbar supports in the chairs at work. Is that true, Leanne?
I tried a little bit, yes.
Okay. Well, there's, you know, having a good support in that lumbar area can go a long way. But also the height of your seat. If the seat's too high for you and you have to reach with your feet to hit the floor, that's going to pull you into a poor posture. This is where a physical therapist, if there's any way that they come in and look at your workstation, or if you saw a physical therapist and you could describe in detail the type of chair, or take a picture of the chair with your phone, and then a picture with you in that chair, how you would typically be sitting at work, and bring that in, that could help analyze, you know, is it a fact that the issue of the chair? The other thing that I have people try sometimes, it's called a back sling chair or a nada chair, NADA. And it's a way to get good back support without using the back of your chair. So when the chair doesn't fit, you know, nice and neatly the way it should, this back sling support can make a huge difference for people. It's much less expensive than a stand-up workstation. It's maybe $50 to $60. If you Google it, you can see where it can be ordered. If sitting is absolutely the worst thing for your back, then yes, there is a place for a stand-up workstation. But like anything else, if you stand long enough, then that can start causing issues as well. So
right.
I guess I would recommend exploring everything you can with your chair and your sitting posture. And again, a physical therapist should be able to problem solve you through this with just a visit or two. And especially if you can bring pictures in of your chair and workstation, if they can't come and see you, and also you in that chair could be helpful.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. We have... you know, we talked about hamstrings a time or two on the show, and we had a Facebook question from Earl about the Green Bay Packers. The Packers have been plagued with hamstring injuries. What can football players do to prevent hamstring injuries? And that might even relate to our high school football players. And
that is a multi-million dollar question.
It is.
Yeah,
it is.
Well, Packers.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Well, typically, one would say strengthening. There are there's a fair amount of research that's been done on hamstring strains and injuries and rehabilitation. In fact, much of that research has been done here at our own UW Sports Medicine Center by some of our staff. So remembering the speed specificity of hamstrings is important. It's not just lifting more weight, but muscle fibers are speed specific. So if you are in a speed position, you want to train your hamstrings not just at heavy resistance, slow repetitions, but also at high speed with less weight. They also do what's called the Russian curl, where instead of lying on your stomach and bending your knees, you actually kneel with your feet hooked underneath something and you lower your body down. So I wouldn't recommend that at home without some instruction for that.
Right.
But but for someone at the Packers level or at the high school level, getting some instruction from a certified coach or athletic trainer or sports medicine physical therapist can help.
Yeah, there's some running clinics where Lori mentioned earlier. They hook you up with electrodes. They put you on a treadmill. They can watch you run. They can analyze. Sometimes modifying, again, the research that's been done here, modifying the running style or running pattern can make a difference in preventing or minimizing hamstring injuries. A little more difficult to do that when you're sprinting, starting and stopping, like on a football field compared to a long distance runner. But there's a number of things that can be modified, at least tried, that have been shown to be effective in some groups.
Right. And interestingly, many times people will do squats because they feel like you get quadriceps, glute, and hamstring all at the same time. But the EMG studies show that that's very individual specific. Some people really recruit their hamstrings while they're squatting. Other people don't recruit them at all. So, you know, if you really want to know, you should have some. You should go into a clinic and have someone slap an EMG on you and see how you're recruiting your muscles.
Lori in Cornell, Wisconsin. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hello. My husband has on the left side, he broke his ankle years ago. Recently, within a year and a half, he broke his, not his ankle on the right, but the lower bone, the small bone in the lower leg, and it has not healed, and it's been a year and a half. When he's walking, he does have a bunion on the left side, and that was quite interesting for me when you said that that can be a cause structure of the hip, but he gets he'll be walking and all of a sudden he'll become unstable and then he can't walk. You know, he like crumples. I mean, he doesn't fall to the ground, but is that his back? Is it that his hip? Or he really doesn't say his ankles give out. It's more like his back.
Okay. Does he describe it as pain or his back? It's weakness.
Well, sometimes it's severe pain, and then sometimes it's just, it is painful.
Okay,
right?
Okay. So, yeah, well, sharp pain will cause people to crumble. I mean, muscles shut off as a reflex at times. Muscles go into spasm to try to protect you. And it could be all the leg issues that he's had over years certainly could have led to changes up in his low back area. Has he seen anybody? Has he seen a physical therapist or physician for his low back?
No, chiropractor.
Okay. All right. Well, the chiropractor should help sort out. Is it a matter of weakness, muscle weakness in terms of what needs to be strengthened, or is there a part of his spine that needs to move better or differently? But I'm thinking
myself because he does have swelling along the spine in the lower back.
Okay.
Maybe all like right. A herniated disc or something. I don't know.
Well, a herniated disc, you won't see the swelling. The disc is too deep. If muscles are in spasm or there could be some local swelling in the back, but the disc is too deep, you won't be able to see that visually.
It seems like with the number of injuries that he's had, I mean, he had an injury where he fractured his left ankle several years ago. Then he had another injury a year and a half ago where he broke this other bone. And sometimes we really focus on, you know, that fracture because it's so here in front of us. But if you had a trauma that was great enough to fracture a bone, chances are you hurt something else at the same time. And you change how you move, and that overloads your knee and your hip and your back. So it's not unreasonable that he probably has some back issues that haven't been addressed because everyone's been focused on the ankle. So going in and getting a good examination from, you know, the back on down to see how he moves, to look at his posture, to look at his flexibility and strength may help sort out where this is coming from.
Okay. Now he has problems with the left ankle, like the screw, you know, that they put in there.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can feel it under the skin.
Yep.
And he probably should have had it removed. Now, what's the damage caused when that, I mean, is that screw loose? Is that why it's coming out? Or can that irritate the bone? Or?
Well, if that was put in years ago, if it's more prominent now, the screw could be backing out. If it's the same prominent as it was before, chances are it isn't. You know, your ankle bones are pretty superficial. You don't have a lot of muscle or subcutaneous fat covering your bones like you do, say, for example, in your thigh. So if you have hardware, it's much easier to feel. So if he feels like it's backing out, he should have it looked at. That's a fairly simple procedure, I believe, to remove those, especially in the ankle, because they are so superficial.
Yep. There you go. Good luck. Thank you, Lori, for calling. We will move to Merrill, Wisconsin next. Let's talk to Jeff. Hey, Jeff, thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
back in June, I was doing a little remodeling and demolition, and I injured my right arm. Kind of, I guess the best way to describe it would be, you know, like an uppercut type of motion. You know, I was using a bar to do a little wrecking, and, you know, slammed into the wall and stopped suddenly. And my arm kind of, you know, dropped and went limp. And at first I thought it was like a biceps tear or a biceps tendon rupture. And, you know, your earlier caller kind of touched base on that. But it's definitely not that because, you know, didn't get that. The muscle didn't ball up. Did see a doctor for it. And, you know, I'm able to, you know, turn my forearm up. I guess that's, like you had mentioned, one of the keys. And but it's still, I had some weakness for a while. It's been doing okay. It's probably at 90-95%, but the bicep still kind of lies funny, like to the inside of the arm. And if I turn my hand so the palm is down, it's like on the other side that the bicep head will move towards the forearm, and in this case it doesn't. So you can definitely see something's not quite right there. You know, the doc said, look, it's not really worth doing an MRI because, you know, it's not the biceps tendon. And he just said, well, give it time. It'll, you know, get better. It hasn't been getting worse necessarily, but it hasn't been getting, you know, hasn't changed much. So I'm just kind of curious what your take on it might be.
Oh, that's a tough one.
Boy.
A number of things come to mind as you were telling your story, and that is some shoulder instability. So one of the classic things when you have that dead arm feeling is that you have shoulder instability. So you could have subluxed your shoulder and had some residual instability from that. You could have had some nerve damage that came all the way from your neck, and even though you have pretty good strength there, there could have been some nerve damage. Additionally, you could have injured another muscle that's deeper, that isn't your primary supinator, your palm turner upper, but there are some other smaller ones like your coracobrachialis or some other smaller muscles that perform similar actions that you could have damaged. So at this point, you know, I'd probably go in and see a physical therapist who specializes in upper extremity, and they can do a very detailed manual muscle testing of all these isolated muscles and see if they can see any pattern, either by muscle or by nerve group innervation, as well as looking at your shoulder to see if your shoulder is a contributing factor and your neck. Because you really have to sort all those things out. With that motion, that uppercut motion, there's a whole bunch of stuff that happens from your neck all the way down through the muscles in your elbow.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't, like I said, I mean, the arm kind of went limp, I think, primarily because that, you know, the muscle, it seemed to me to be more muscle related. And, you know, now, like I said, I'm back pretty much, you know, I'm close to full strength, but like if I do a lot of repetitions, if I'm, let's say, doing pull-ups or that type of motion, I can definitely feel, you know, where it's either weaker or it doesn't have the endurance. And so, yeah, that's what I was kind of curious about.
Okay.
Some deep muscle that might have gotten, you know, tore.
So let me ask you this. Does your biceps, you said something about it not looking quite the same.
Mm-hmm.
Is it not, it still doesn't look quite the same? Does it look as developed as your other one?
Yeah, probably. I guess kind of when if it flexes normally, but then, like I said, there's that the fact that it kind of is on the outside of the arm, it doesn't seem to be as you know, like there's, it looks like there's something missing.
The other possibility is that you didn't rupture your biceps from the top down. That's when it rolls up like the window shade, like our earlier caller Will had. You can rupture your biceps from the bottom end up, in which case it won't roll up because there's enough other connective tissue where it will stay somewhat attached there. If you haven't seen an orthopedist, if you've only seen your family practice physician, I'd either go there or see a good physical therapist to sort this out. Because rupturing from the bottom end is certainly a more serious situation. Those are usually fixed surgically.
Okay.
All right. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, Jeff, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Are there, you know, we've talked about a bunch of different injuries. Are there other types of injuries that you tend to see a lot of at this time of the year? Trying to think of.
You know, I think it's more to do with either the yard work, you know, that people are doing to fall, to kind of prepare for the winter. And then, of course, once the snow comes, then it's the shoveling. It's the falls. We have to start thinking about falls with black ice and snow covering black ice.
I also see people who injure themselves getting decorations, like lifting boxes down from shelves or climbing around in attics or climbing on ladders.
Outside, putting them up. Yeah.
Yes, right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Who are in that extended position, arms overhead, their back arch for long periods of time.
Yeah, things that are, you know, we're lifting things that are awkward in terms of shape and sometimes heavy. And then it's easy for a slip or a bump.
So be careful out there.
Yeah.
Be careful out there.
Yeah, kind of plan things out. And if there's a second person to help lift and carry some of these things, you know, pulling some reinforcements. Yes.
Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody, our guests. They'll be back next month, December 16th.
Excellent.
As a matter of fact. And they'll be with us again. And certainly they'll have some more advice for you. And thank you for listening. Tomorrow we'll take a look at Beaujolais Nouveau wine and the science of beer. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.